Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Hello, I'm Jason, and I support Gen X Grown Up on Patreon. You should do the same, because the world just needs more GXG to make it a better place. Just go to genxgrownup.com/patreon to donate to the cause.
No life, no fun. Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
Gen X Grown-Up is a YouTube channel, website, and audio podcast you're listening to right now. All made for and by people who love exploring media, games, tech, and toys of yesterday and today through the eyes of Gen Xers who refuse to grow up.
Your dinner cannot just be french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up.
Welcome back, Gen X Grown-Up podcast listener, to this backtrack edition of the Gen X Grown-Up podcast. I'm John. Joining me, as always, is George.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
And Mo is here with us, as always.
Hey, everybody.
In this episode, you know, if you are a fan of horror, action, or science fiction films from the 70s or 80s, then you're a fan of John Carpenter, whether you know it or not.
Yeah, for sure.
This American director, producer, actor, screenwriter, and composer celebrates his 73rd birthday this past week. So in this episode, we're going to celebrate some of our favorite John Carpenter films and discuss just what makes them so memorable.
I mean, we could go for days on this topic.
We were saying, right, we could pick one film and talk for a whole show, right?
Yeah. So we're going to limit ourselves to like four, right?
We are. Yeah, we picked some. We could do four or five more of these episodes in the future.
We could do another four easily.
So many great Carpenter films.
Oh, well, we could do this episode, then take an episode and do each one of these films more in depth.
No kidding.
Even.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
Just ridiculous.
Yeah, they're just so much a part of the Gen X experience, for sure. Before we get into gushing over how much we love John Carpenter films, though, real quickly, it's time for some fourth listener email. And the email this time is from Mike C., our longtime listener Patreon supporter. Mike writes in with a subject line, Gift Guide for Geeks Podcast, which you'll remember he suggested we do, right?
Mm-hmm. Did somebody get the TV? That's what I want to know.
Oh, I don't know. Did you get the TV, George?
I didn't get the TV.
Mike writes in and says, good morning. I hope you and your family enjoyed a great Christmas holiday. I wanted to share with you that Mrs. C. heard the opening of the Gift Guide for Geeks podcast while I was getting the Christmas ornaments out of the garage this holiday. When she heard you mention that I wrote in asking about advice on gifts,
oops,
her jaw just about hit the floor. she looked at me straight in the eye and said, you got credit for that? I should get the credit for the topic since I've been asking you what you want for Christmas for the last month. I laughed a bit nervously and told her I would send her the link to the podcast so she could hear the list of ideas. While she did not choose a gift idea from the list, she did get me some cool tech, including a multi-card reader and a metal detector.
Oh, okay.
Well, good. You got some cool stuff.
Metal detector. Wow.
That I never thought I wanted one until I heard him say that. And then
I know.
It's like,
what the hell's buried in my yard?
I think about the guys on Oak Island, the guys that are looking for treasure. They find the coins and get excited. Oh, yeah. Mike says, thanks for the gift ideas and the podcast. By the way, I am still going to take credit for the topic idea since I actually wrote in about it. Fair.
He should.
Wow.
Yes.
You've earned it. Just don't tell Mrs. C, and I think you'll be fine.
Yeah. I think we just did.
Yeah.
Right? If she listens. Sorry, Mrs. C. Mike stole it. He wraps it up by saying, fourth listener and Patreon of Gen X Grown Up. Nice. Mike C. Cool. Thank you, Mike.
That's great.
We love it every time the fourth listener writes in. If you would like your email featured here on the show, just hit us up at podcast@genxgrownup.com or swing by our Discord channel. Drop a line in the fourth listener thread there. Okay, we have put it off long enough. It is time to jump into these awesome films of John Carpenter, and we're going to do that right after this break. Stick around.
1988. The crime rate in the United States rises 400%. 1991, the United States Police Force is formed. 1997, New York City is a walled maximum security prison. John Carpenter's Escape from New York, the ultimate adventure of escape and survival.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not, it's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.
Let's jump into the films we've selected to talk about for John Carpenter, celebrating his birthday just recently. But the reason it's important, as we noted at the beginning, is that so many of his films in the 70s and 80s, not all of them were box office smashes, but they became absolute cornerstones of the Gen X experience and cult favorites that we go back to again and again. So I am tickled shitless that the first one we picked is one of my absolute favorite films from that era. The introduction of Snake Plissken, Escape from New York in 1981.
Yes. What a crazy movie that was.
Oh, I love, love, love. I love this film as much as I hate Escape from L.A., the sequel.
I think a lot of John Carpenter fans probably feel similarly.
Yeah,
they should. Okay, before we get too deep in it, I'll read you the brief description on the off chance that you have not seen Escape from New York. In 1997, when the U.S. president crashes into Manhattan, now a giant maximum security prison,
of course,
a convicted bank robber is sent in to rescue him.
Mm.
And that, of course, is Snake Plissken.
I grew up in New York, and I was really offended that they turned Manhattan into a prison.
Well, it's an easy landmass to just cut off. You cut off the bridges.
You know, they could have done the entire state of Rhode Island, and it would have been fine.
It's not quite as landlocked, though, Mo.
Nor quite as good for the visuals.
True.
Yeah.
Oh, it was such a great movie.
So first of all, Kurt Russell, who is a continuous collaborator with John Carpenter, and to great effect. Donald Pleasance as the president, Ernest Borgnine, Isaac Hayes,
number one,
the Duke of New York.
Right.
One thing I'll say that with Kurt Russell, when he does all these Carpenter films, he like hits that almost edge of overdoing it, right? He's right at that bleeding edge. He doesn't quite cross it. Maybe a couple times he does, but it's perfect for these movies, though.
You know, and I think a big part of why John Carpenter films feel like John Carpenter films is because he's not just a writer.
No.
He's not just a director. he's a double, triple, quadruple threat something. He often, for many of his films, he directs and writes and produces and composes the music, and sometimes he even edits.
Yeah.
And so his fingerprints are on every piece of it. That's why no other director from that era had such a super signature style. Now, George, we were talking before the show that there's a really interesting trivia nugget related to something that happened at the end of the film, right?
Yeah, I mean, being a John Carpenter super fan, I try to familiarize myself with every aspect of these films, because it's, for me, it's not just enough to watch the films. I really want to know everything about how they were made and what his decision processes were when he was figuring stuff out for logistics and things like that. And this one, Escape from New York, has some interesting things. I know Mo said he was offended that New York was used as the backdrop for this. However, New York was not actually the filming location for some of the more memorable scenes in this film. And at the end of it, there's the big chase across a bridge for Snake Plissken and the president to scale the wall and get out. Duke of New York is chasing him down, and there's mines everywhere. Turns out that was an actual bridge, not in New York, but in St. Louis. It's called the Old Chain of Rocks Bridge.
Really?
And John Carpenter bought that bridge from St. Louis for the grand total of $1.
Okay.
So he owns a bridge?
He did. He owned the bridge for that time while he was filming, and then he returned it to him free of charge after they finished the film.
That smells like insurance liability reasons right there.
Yeah,
I'm sure it was, right?
The city's like, it's not our bridge.
Right, not our bridge. People get blown up. It's all on you, John.
It's your bridge.
It's just one of those really cool little factoids about that film. Because, you know, I want to say this is the most iconic John Carpenter film on our list, but goddamn it, they're all iconic.
They all are, right, for different reasons, actually. Right,
yeah. So, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but the one memory I kind of still latch on to growing up, you know, now being an adult, is I wasn't a huge reader when I was younger. I didn't really become a big book reader until I was probably 19, 20 or so. And then I just wanted to read everything. But this is one of the few instances where I saw a film, and then later on, we're at the grocery store. I'm sure it was a Publix or Winn-Dixie or something like that. And they had a little book section at the grocery stores at that time. And this book, after I had rented it on VHS, was somehow in that bookstore in that grocery store. And I bought it and read it in 2 days. And the book is different from the film. There are quite a few things in the book that are not in the movie.
The Book of Escape from New York? Really?
Yeah.
Is it a novelization of the movie, or was the movie based on this book?
I honestly, you know,
don't know
as
which?
Much as you would think I would know that. I honestly don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg.
I didn't know that even existed.
I didn't either. I'm going to check out this. So
there's a whole scene about the Chock Full of Nuts place where he goes to watch the little show and everything, and the president's down and thing.
Right.
There's a whole scene about that whole environment there in the book that's not in the film.
Now I have to seek this out. Okay, can I find this book online? I'll have to look. I'll make a note.
It.
Okay.
Found it.
Mo's already
did
find
you already?
It.
Mo's already got it.
it's apparently it was a novelization of the movie.
Okay.
Oh.
So they probably took the original script and probably had stuff that they cut out that they
cut out.
Would make
that's
sense.
Cool.
Yeah.
But I can tell you right now that it's out of print, unfortunately. But you can buy a used paperback of it for $100.
$100? I've got this book somewhere. It's worth $100.
That's
you still
what it's
have
on
it?
Amazon.
Yes,
so
I'm still got
it.
Wow. I keep all my books.
I had no idea. That's cool.
Well, damn, I just made $100. This is a hell of a podcast. Let's keep going.
Like you're
going
to sell that book. Give
no,
me
I'm
real.
Never
going to
sell it.
Better.
Oh, man. And so this movie is like I love all John Carpenter movies too. Like, I'm with you, George. I'm a big fan of his stuff. Mm. This one, though, is like when I first saw it when I was a kid, right, in New York, loved it. It's all we talked about, right?
Right.
I mean, the fact that he flew a glider, landed on the World Trade Center.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, and the whole thing, like his head was going to explode if he didn't do it in time. No, I mean, loved it. Then it's funny. I saw it probably, I was probably in my 20s. And I just didn't like it. I was like, oh my God.
Okay.
I was like, this movie's like really stupid. I just didn't get it. And then like 10 years later, I saw it again. And I'm like, what was I thinking? This is brilliant.
It is. Yeah.
Like, I was going through some weird trying to be mature thing, I think, somewhere in there that just made me not like it. But then I kind of grew out of that. And so I just liked it again later.
I think it's fair to say it's an agreed upon love fest for Escape from New York, despite the fact that Mo hated it when he was trying to be grown up in the middle of his life.
Yeah, trying to be. It didn't last long. You know.
George had a great suggestion how we're going to wrap up each one of these films we discuss to talk about one of our favorite scenes, kind of like do a little round table and talk about. And George, I want to ask you first, you have a favorite scene from Escape from New York, if you can pick one of the so many, the great ones.
Geez.
I mean, you're right. There's like every 30 seconds is a new great scene in these films for me. I think one of my favorites, one of the ones that sticks in my memory the most, at least, it's kind of an unusual one because it doesn't involve Snake Plissken at all. It doesn't involve the president. It doesn't involve the Duke of New York either.
Hmm.
Cabby, none of the main characters that you think of. But there's a scene where Lee Van Cleef leads a SWAT team into New York just after the crash, right? The plane crashes into the World Trade Center,
the
which, by
escape,
the way,
the first
horribly prophetic.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
And as the little wireframe graphic shows, there's an escape egg that pops out of the plane.
What horrible 80s digital graphics.
I know.
Right? Like, beep, 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 beep. And then the egg itself looked like Mork's egg from Mork and Mindy.
Yeah.
So they get there. The egg is sitting in the rubble. It's already opened and everything, and they can't find the president. And then this really weird, creepy guy walks around from a corner, and he's got this frizzy hairstyle kind of in the Guile format, and he's got the makeup on and everything. And he walks up, and he hands them a package, and he's like, you guys have 60 seconds to leave or he dies. If you do this, he dies. If you do this, he dies. You know, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And the guy, Lee Van Cleef, opens a package, and it's the president's finger with the presidential ring.
Ring on it.
They just cut it off. Lee Van Cleef, he grabs his people. They take off. And the last thing is the crazy guy. He just looks at him running away, and he goes, ha! Like that, just kind of weird, evil.
Like he's a feral
thing.
Animal.
Yep. I love that scene.
Oh, there's so many great ones.
Yeah.
But to pick one for me, this is going to sound like a cop out, but I love the character of Snake Plissken so much. It's the introduction of Snake Plissken when he's getting his assignment, and just how indifferent he is right at the beginning when they draft him and bring him in, and they tell him the deal, and then they screw him over. They think he's getting an inoculation or something, and he put the bomb. in him and give him a stupid little LCD watch that looks like a giant Apple Watch on his wrist. But just the introduction of Snake Plissken, because I love Kurt Russell so much, and he was chewing on scenery as that character. And so any scene he's in, but the introduction of him probably for me is the favorite.
Get yourself a new president.
Oh my God, I love it. Oh my God, you're right. Mo, how about you? Favorite scene? Can you think of one?
Again, there's just so many. Okay, this is a scene that made me laugh for some reason. It probably shows like where my brain was at that time. But when they're crossing the bridge at the end, right?
Yeah.
And the guy has the map with the layout over the mines.
The brain.
Right? Yeah, exactly. The brain. Thank you.
Yeah.
Everyone else is going like one direction. He's saying, no, no, no. Go this way. Go this way. And he winds up walking into a landmine.
Right. Because he misread the map.
Yeah. And I'm like, for some reason, I just like started laughing at that scene. Because I was like, wait a minute. First off, none of them are following this freaking map anyway.
No, they're just running. Nobody's just following running. Him at all.
Yeah, and he's the one with the map with so he could lead him across this bridge, and he winds up dying. And I was like, really? It was just a weird scene to throw in there. Like, I guess they couldn't have them all live at the end, I guess. So they had to find some way of killing him
off.
They
had to kill him off, yeah.
So yeah. I guess that was a convenient way to get rid of him. But for some reason, that scene just sticks in my head.
Yeah, everything that could have gone wrong in this movie went wrong, and that was just one more thing at the tail end. Yeah.
12 men have just discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to. But it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's one.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey, and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listenersurvey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
Okay, so moving on to other Carpenter movies, this one is in my top three favorite horror movies. Stress me out of all time.
That's fair. Yep.
The thing.
Oh,
it's
boy.
Up there with Alien. It's kind of similar to Alien in a way, in the sense that, you know, there's a monster and these people are secluded, but I never seen a movie that stressed up the stress part of the pun more in me, just trying to guess who was the alien, who wasn't. The movie's about a research team in Antarctica that's hunted by a shape-shifting alien that can assume the appearance and mannerisms of anybody.
What a simple premise.
Yeah, it's
that you
so
could have
simple.
Done anywhere. And it's been done a million times before.
Yeah, but no
one's
done it
this good. But that claustrophobic Antarctic research station with just a, here are the people, that's all you have to work with. It's just a self-contained little bubble. Oh, but it ratcheted up the stress and the, oh man, right.
I think this movie, for me, he does such a good job of like, it doesn't go like 0 to 100. It just slowly ramps. Like, but
it's a slow burn.
And it ratchets up. It never backs off. It's always
right,
clicking.
It never stops.
One more notch.
Like, it's always increasing, right? Throughout the whole movie. And like, even from the scene where the dog is running across and the other people are shooting at it. And then, you know, I'm thinking like, okay, that's weird. Okay, why is the guy chasing a dog? And even during the movie, I thought, wow, that's really far for a dog to run. <You know? laughs> Oh my God, I just love this movie so much. I mean, George, I'm sure this is one of your favorites too, right?
Oh yeah, no question. I mean, we should definitely talk about who was in this film because that's a key component to almost every John Carpenter film. He does a great job.
Well, first, Snake Plissken was in it.
Yeah, Snake Plissken.
No, Kurt Russell. Was in it.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Everybody's favorite crazy granddad, Wilford Brimley, and Keith David, who is also a staple of the John Carpenter universe. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It just boggles the mind. And I kind of want to do a little piece of trivia in each one of these movies just because,
good.
Like I said,
Lay it on me.
In this one, this is the first of John Carpenter's films, which he did not do the score himself. As a matter of fact, the only role that he took on in this film was that of director.
Oh.
Everything else was somebody else.
Unusual.
The film's original choice of a composer was Jerry Goldsmith, but he passed. So they got Ennio Morricone, who composed a very low-key Carpenter-like score with the brooding and bass chords and everything else, just like Carpenter would do.
Right.
So that's why everybody thinks Carpenter
did this one. I totally thought he did the composition for this,
but he didn't.
And all of these, you have that kind of like, dum, 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 dum. Like there's this ongoing bass line that goes from scene to scene. It doesn't stop, almost like you're doing a music video. Mm-hmm. And so I initially thought the thing was also Carpenter because it has that feel. So he was mimicking the Carpenter style,
and
I guess.
His bass lines, John, you're a music guy, so you'll understand this. To me, his bass lines, they're not typical bass lines when you think of them. Like you were just mimicking one. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah. Yep.
His bass lines are very slow and methodical.
Yeah.
And
they're sometimes just like a two-note chord. It's really creepy. And I think to Mo's point about this being a slow burn, that's why this score works so well for this film, because it really drives that point home on that level.
Yeah, there was a lot of scenes that had no music, right? Which was weird because you think some of these movies, like they always have some background sound at all, but there were a lot of scenes in this that had nothing, like just dead silence at parts.
Absolutely.
Which made it even creepier to
me. You're in the frozen tundra of Antarctica.
Right.
So that feels even more, it's hard to say it, but it feels even more claustrophobic. You're in this great wide open space, but the whole film feels claustrophobic, and so much so that to this day, this movie is 40 years old at this point almost. My son was still freaked out by this film when he first watched it, and he was...
Oh, it's 16?
Oh, this
when he totally saw it. Holds up.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
This itself was a remake of the film from the 50s, and I think they did another remake in the 2000s.
Yeah,
which was a remake.
It was more of a sequel they did.
It was a prequel.
Oh, okay. A prequel.
It was
a prequel.
Yes, it was a prequel.
But, I mean, neither of those hold a candle to it. I mean, this one right in the 80s was just the perfect, like, the effects were more practical, less digital, but it was gritty, and plus, everything just comes together where you're in this area where you have to trust the people you're with, and you don't know if the person you're talking to is even the person you're talking to. And so there's this anxiety.
Yeah.
It's like, what's the stupid game that we play online? The one where you're not sure who the bad guy is. Should you be alone with them or not? It's like an early version of that, but it would really cranked up the creep factor. Mm-hmm.
Talk about the stress. I mean, just the scene that probably just stressed me out so much when I first saw this is when they're all tied to the bench.
Oh, yeah. The testing.
And then one of them turns out to be the alien, right?
Yeah.
That scene, I almost couldn't watch it because I put myself in this, being the guy next to the alien in the bench.
Right. You don't know. You know?
I mean, that's just like horror. That's like pure torture to be in that position. Oh my God. Just thinking about it makes me like raise my stress levels.
You talk about scenes. I think it's probably time that we get to our favorite scenes of this film.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
I'm just curious. I want to know what John's favorite scene is in this movie.
Oh, well, so Mo, you touched on it. I think not so much the being strapped to the bench, but the whole testing of the blood scene. Yeah. Where they finally have figured
that
out
that sound in the petri dish when he sprayed the
water, and it screams.
Oh, the chalkboard.
And the thing is that you don't know who the alien is.
Mm-mm. Oh, and they don't. That's the point. And what I loved about it, I think, I mean, of course, there's the stress and the drama and the ratcheting up. I love that they have found a scientific way to definitively know who is the thing.
Right.
And, you know, they heat up the coil of wire and they put it. And it just, if it fizzles out, you're like, oh, you take a sigh, they ratchet up the angst. It reminded me in preparing for the show, there's an episode in the 11th season of South Park called Licecapades, where somebody in the class had lice,
right?
And they're all trying to figure out who it is so they can make fun of him. And Cartman has devised this. He said, well, lice leave a little bit of their saliva in your bloodstream. And if I touch it with a hot wire, it'll jump 10 foot out of the dish. And he does the same test. And Kyle even says, you didn't think of this. You stole this from that movie, The Thing.
Well, if you steal from the best.
Oh,
but even
goodness.
Before South Park, I just loved how science is taking over and they figured something out. Didn't really work really well for them in the long term, but I just loved that scene. What about you, Mo? Favorite scene?
Oh my God. One of my favorite scenes that just kind of, for me, just gave that feeling of just hopelessness in the movie was when everyone's favorite grandpa,
Wilford Brimley.
Yeah, when they know he's crazy after he breaks out the radios, they throw him in the room and later they check on him.
Right.
And he's sitting there and he's like super calm. Yo, guys, I'd like to come out now. I'm totally fine. And there's a silhouette of a noose hanging up in his cell.
Exactly.
But he's calm. He's like, I'm fine. No, you can let me out. I understand why you did it. I was a little out of control, but there's like a freaking noose hanging in his cell. And I was like watching that scene. I was like, wow. I mean, that's just like, I totally felt how hopeless they felt.
It just adds another layer of desperation and hopelessness. Yeah.
Well, especially when you see it later on, you discover that he himself had already been compromised.
right,
and was building the spaceship, you know that that noose was just a way for him to try and trick them into thinking that he was a human who was thinking about committing suicide. You're like, God damn, that's clever.
Yeah,
that's
all awesome. Those layers.
Yeah.
My goodness.
So, George, what was yours?
I think it's probably one of the most widely thought of scenes from that film. It's the chest crash scene.
Oh, my God.
The one guy supposedly has a heart attack, and the doctor is trying to revive him.
Oh, man.
And he's got the shock paddles, and he's clear, boom, clear. And then he, like, the third time, just boom, the whole chest opens up, and it's a giant mouth of teeth.
It just bites his
bites his arms off.
Yes.
The practical effects in that, oh, my goodness, they were so great. The head separates from the body, becomes the spider
head. The scene doesn't stop there. It's not like the chest burster from Alien. It's like, first the arms get bitten off, then his head drops on the floor, and it sprouts legs and runs off like a spider, and you're like, holy shit!
Was that the scene where, like, the stoner dude looks at it, and he's like, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah, and that's what I'm talking about. Like, because the best part of that scene is exactly that. When the head is sitting over there and it starts to crawl out, and the stoner guy's like, what? Everybody's just kind of like mesmerized by this thing trying to slowly escape across the floor. And they're like, what the hell is that? It's just awesome.
Oh my God, that's such a great scene. You're right, though. And also, that was just unexpected as, like, the first time the alien facehugger jumps out in the Alien movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Like, that was like a shock. That's the same level of like, what the hell?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. That was such a great scene.
I've come up with a test that can determine if it was any of us who had the head lice. We're going to find out once and for all who had head cooties. Lice feed on a person's blood. And just like mosquitoes, they leave behind small traces of their saliva in the host's bloodstream. That saliva is monochromagnic. So if an infected person's blood is touched by this hot metal coil, say, that person's blood will jump 10 meters into the air. Really?
That's retarded. You didn't come up with that experiment, Carmen. You saw in that movie, The Thing.
My name is Cindy Burnett, and each week I interview at least two traditionally published authors on my podcast, Thoughts from a Page. We talk spoiler-free about their books, so you can listen whether you have read the book or not. And then we delve into things that you most likely won't hear about anywhere else. The importance of the cover design, why they included various aspects of the story, personal details about both the books and the authors' lives, and so much more. You can find the podcast on every major platform and learn more about it on my website, thoughtsfromapage.com. Thanks so much for checking it out.
We're jumping ahead a few years to 1986 now, and it's time to hop on board the Pork Chop Express.
We're on the road. And
again with Snake Plissken. It's another Kurt Russell film.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about Big Trouble in Little China.
On a dark and stormy night when you're worried about what's going on, you just listen to old Jack Burton.
Burton? This thing is like a comic book come to life on the screen. Oh,
yes.
The concept is a rough and tumble trucker helps rescue his friend's fiance from an ancient sorcerer in a supernatural battle beneath Chinatown.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what happens, but it does not do the film justice if that's all you
close.
Know about it. Oh,
not even
my
close.
Lord. I mentioned Kurt Russell, also, of course, Kim Cattrall and James Hong, among many other great talent in this. Oh, good heavens, Big Trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you gave that synopsis. I've got another trivia thing for you, but there's
it.
Also another
it?
Part.
Here.
Oh, okay.
This was not the way that Carpenter envisioned this story. In his mind, Jack Burton was the gullible sidekick, and the Asian guy was supposed to be the hero. That's why he's so bumbling halfway through the movie. He always gets knocked out.
He
drops his gun all the time and everything. But it was the studio that said, no, Kurt Russell's a more bankable person. We need him to be the star. So that's why a whole bunch of stuff in this got reshot and rewritten and recut, because they wanted to make him the hero.
It worked.
Yeah.
Well, but you know, he is the hero, but the fact that he is an incompetent hero makes the film that much more beloved.
Mm-hmm. He's lovable, right?
He succeeds despite himself. He's well-meaning, but he, you know, don't forget the safety, you know, look out there, and he's, you know, rolls backwards in the wheelchair or whatever. He can't do it on his own, really, but he's so braggadocious about it that he acts like he can.
And another piece of trivia, the guy who was supposed to originally play the one he was helping out to save his fiance, that was supposed to be Jackie Chan.
Really?
Oh, really?
Yep, Jackie Chan turned it down.
Oh, missed opportunity.
Yep. And I mean, there was all kinds of things, but the trivia part that I pulled up.
There's more?
Which is even crazier.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Kurt Russell turned down the lead role of Connor McLeod in Highlander to do this movie.
Wow.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Kurt Russell. I so much appreciate your decisions here.
Well, I'm glad because I can't see anybody else doing that role, but wow.
It's just bonkers. This is one of my favorite films of all time, if you can't tell.
I love this movie. I mean, the martial arts were amazing.
Yes.
And the people they got to play were like real China martial arts people. Like they did like the whole Kung Fu movie. They're all like really well known in that area.
Yeah. And several great stunt men and stunt coordinators play the different, you know, the Tongs and the groups that were fighting against each other in the alleyway. Mm-hmm. They're like the leaders of those groups.
Yeah.
Oh, so good.
Something I really always enjoyed about this film is that you saw many of the key bad guys in multiple kind of roles. Like you saw them in their magical, mystical self.
Mm-hmm.
And then you saw them as these badass businessmen when they weren't doing that.
Right.
And the fact that they had these many facets made them feel that much more menacing because they're not just voiceless, faceless bad guys. They're like a guy in a suit going, oh, come with me down the freight elevator. Let me help you out. Kind of. And then shit goes down, you know?
The elementals are some of my favorite parts of that film. Those three guys, they're awesome.
And they're so hokey, but they're wonderful.
But they're great. Oh, my God.
And the reference to a Bruce Lee film where they pose as phone fixers, you know, phone installer guys to get backstage. Yep. Oh, love that stuff. It's so good.
Yeah.
This is one of the early films that I remember, maybe one of the first films that I remember renting on VHS. Like, I know the first one or two verbatim, but within that first month of owning or renting, maybe we had a VHS, I remember getting this movie because the cover just looks outrageous.
Oh, it's awesome.
It's Kurt Russell with the two machine guns. And
what does the name mean? Big Trouble in Little China. And it's it's like this splash of text. And there's all these different ninjas. And there's Jack Burton I saw in there.
They're like all popping out from behind
them.
Yes,
they're all jumping off the thing. And I'm like, this has got to be the most amazing thing ever. And it turned out it really was.
You know, my favorite memory about this film isn't from when the film first came out or when I rented it on VHS. Several years later, my son, he started to get to the age where you can introduce him to things that you liked and he'll comprehend them.
Yeah.
So I wanted to introduce him to John Carpenter stuff. And it just so happened that there's a place here in Tallahassee called the Cap City Video Lounge, which they screen old movies and TV shows and anime and stuff like that in this like 30 or 40 person seat theater. And they had a John Carpenter night and Big Trouble in Little China was on the double bill.
Great.
So I took my son to go see that. So he got to see it in a theater environment
in
the 2000s.
Should.
And to me, that's still one of my favorite memories of stuff that I've done with my son, because I got to share something with him in an environment similar to what I got to view it in 40 years prior.
Yeah. That's one of the best parts of being a parent is forcing all of your favorite things on them. That's fantastic. That's good parenting right there.
Yeah, sure. You better. I remember, because I actually saw this in the theater when it first came out.
Mm.
This sticks in my head. It was the first movie I ever saw by myself.
Oh, wow. No friends? No family?
Yeah, because I couldn't find anyone to go that particular night. You know, I really wanted to see it. And I think it was my brother's like, why don't you just go? And I'm like, it just felt weird. And so I was like, sure, I'll do it. And I went by myself, saw the movie. And to this day, I've regretted doing that because you had no one to talk to afterwards. And there was so much to talk about with this movie. There was so much to talk about. So I went home. I was sitting there. Then I went home and started telling my brothers about it. Of course, it doesn't come off nearly as good when you're retelling it. You know, they're like, yeah, it sounded like a really great movie. Oh, lightning. Yeah, okay, I get that. You know, like, no, it was really cool.
You imagine describing this film to someone who's never seen it and trying to make it not sound like a madman made this film?
Well, it sounded like I was freaking insane.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure I did.
Well, and that's the great thing about Carpenter's films, right? They dance that line of hokiness and exquisite fun at the same time. And this film maybe embodies that more than any other in his repertoire. I mean, it's incredible.
I think almost all of Zeus, maybe except for The Thing and a couple others, there's always that little, I don't know what you would call it.
Tongue-in-cheek kind
of a little
feel.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. A little bit of that. Yeah, like, he's like a little wink at the crowd a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because he does something that's a little over the top. You know it's purposeful because nothing this guy does is an accident, right?
Right.
Like when thunder explodes at the end of the movie, you know, literally, like he gets huge and explodes. That was a weird scene, but it was hilarious.
It made sense in this world that Carpenter created, but it does not make sense explaining to another rational human being outside of this film, which is what makes it so crazy and amazing. So let's talk about favorite scenes again before we get out of this one. I'll go first this time because it is something about Kurt Russell. Maybe it's a cheat, but there are so many one-liners that he gives. Those are the highlight of the film for me. And some of them just illustrate how much he thinks of himself. Like he walks in, everybody relax, I'm here. And then he takes off with his buddy and he says something about, all right, you guys hold down the fort. If we're not back in an hour, call the president or something. You don't realize it's just you and this guy. Nobody else thinks you're awesome. Nobody else is paying attention to you in the world, but he's so important in his brain that it's illustrated at the beginning when he's talking on the CB to nobody. Nobody's listening. And he's giving this, like he's holding court and telling about himself and his history. Just, yeah, Jack Burton is another. He's like a Snake Plissken right up there. So beloved. And because it's Kurt Russell. He's so great.
Yes, he's great.
What about you, George? Favorite scene? Can you pick one?
Oh, Jesus. So from second one to second hour 36. No, I'm just kidding. I would have to say probably the hell of the upside down center is one of my favorite scenes.
Yep.
So the whole thing, they're in this elevator as they're trying to infiltrate the lair of the evil sorcerer. Uh-huh. And they get in this elevator and they go down and the elevator stops and it starts filling up with water, right? And in order to escape, they pry open the doors. And when they pry open the doors, they end up in this room with chains and dead corpses hanging around everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's just so freaky and creepy.
Their feet are in the air, but they've been chained underwater. Yeah. And screams on their face.
My goodness. So creepy. And it ties into the whole Asian mysticism architecture that this film is built on. I think that's one of the scenes that just really drives home the point that Jack Burton is a fish out of water, literally and physically and everything else. I mean, he just, oh, it's brilliant. He shouldn't be there. There's no way he should survive this. And somehow he muddles through.
And there's that running gag of all the different hells that you have.
Yeah, right.
And even like we pokes fun at like, really, there's a hell for that? No, I'm just messing with you.
It says keep out.
Right. What about you, Mo? Favorite scene? I know it's tough.
Again, there's so many, but the one that thinks of when they're in the tunnel to infiltrate the citadel, whatever you want to call it.
Oh, they're getting jazzed up?
No, but they have to go through the tunnel first. Like sewer tunnel.
You're talking about when they're going back in the second time.
Yes, the back in the second time.
Oh,
yeah.
Gotcha.
And like there's like this offshoot tunnel. One of the guys looks in it and this monster jumps out, grabs him, and the guy throws like this grenade thing. And he says, it will not come out. And then Burton's like,
Shin.
What?
Yeah.
Egg Shin. And Burton's like, what? What won't come out? What the hell was that? What was that? Because he was like this big bravado guy, but you can see how insecure and how scary he is because that's how he just endeared the character to me. Because it's like,
you will come out no more. What?
Because that is what
come out. What the hell was that?
Exactly. That's what I would react. Like, what? I mean, yeah, it will come out, but what the hell was it? You know, that was such a great scene.
Not important. Moving on.
Oh, man.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
It's a pretty amazing planet we live on here, and a man would have to be some kind of fool to think we're all alone in this universe.
Jack Burton's coming to rescue your summer.
Hey, what more can a guy ask for?
20th Century Fox presents Kurt Russell in John Carpenter's Big Trouble in Little China.
It's on the reflexes.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, 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 cut.
Oh, what? Come on, it wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on cannedairpodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.
All right, gentlemen, time to jump to 1988 to one of my all-time favorite John Carpenter films, They Live.
Uh-huh.
This film, holds a special place in my heart for so many reasons, not to mention the cast, of course, was one of my favorite parts about this film.
Kind of ridiculous, but kind of awesome.
Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and get the synopsis of this film out of the way. 1988, they influence our decisions without us knowing it. They numb our senses without us feeling it. They control our lives without us realizing it. They live.
Yeah, they do.
If you just read that, you're like, what the hell is that? You might watch the first 2 minutes out of curiosity, and that's all you need. You watch the first 2 minutes of that film, you're hooked. I'm telling you, that film is awesome. The cast in this film is incredible. First off, the star of this film, one of the few films that he actually did. He did several, but none of them were terribly successful. This was his most popular film of all time. Roddy Piper.
What a casting
choice. The wrestling icon himself. Oh, my God.
Wrestling, not wrestling.
No. He was a wrestler. He was not in the wrestling company. The wrestling company is in the South. He was from WWE in the North.
Yeah.
He was a wrestler.
Okay. All right. I will defer to your wrestling knowledge. OK,
I mean, and don't forget, he actually started wrestling when he was 15.
Oh, wow.
OK, yeah, this guy, he's an incredible character and human being himself. It's a great thing. I would love to talk about him someday on the podcast, but I'll go on to the rest of the cast. Keith David, who we talked about from They Live.
Yeah. Another one from the John Carpenter repertory squad.
Exactly.
Yep.
And
the thing,
not from the They Live thing. I'm just focused on They Live right now.
Right.
And probably the actress with maybe the most iconic eyes in all of sci-fi horror history, Meg Foster. Mm-hmm. She had the craziest eye color.
Weird color, weren't they?
It was like a ice blue green kind of, oh my God, it was freaky. And it was perfect for this kind of storyline, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know about you guys. I've got so many memories from this film.
Well, let me start by, why don't you lay some trivia on us? You've gathered some trivia for these cool films. Let's start there.
So what's the most iconic line from this film?
Oh, I'm here to chew bubblegum and kick ass.
And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Right.
So according to John Carpenter, Roddy Piper is the man who wrote that line because he had used it in other situations from his wrestling background.
Oh, really?
Nice.
Yep. And it is. I think it's got to be the most iconic line in the entire film. And we talk about quotable things from Big Trouble in Little China and The Thing and Escape from New York. This film, that's the line. You say that line, everybody's heard it, even if they don't know what film it's from.
Yeah. You know, this film isn't littered with lots of different quotable lines. It's much more action driven. I mean, there's plenty of good stuff in it, don't get me wrong. But it's not full of those quips.
No. And the quips that they're there, Roddy Piper delivers them all.
And they're gems. That's right.
Lady, that's like putting perfume on a pig.
And I think it's ironic that this is basically a buddy film, right? So they're both like these construction worker, day laborer guys. Roddy Piper just comes into town, then he's got his buddy Keith David there, whatever his character name was. But initially, they're tentative friends, hesitant friends. And then when they finally get together, this has got to be, did this film like win an award for the longest one-on-one street alley fight ever on film?
I'd say one of the best.
I know MTV gave it a best fight award or something.
It's not just a fist fight. They beat the living hell out of each other for 20 minutes.
It was like a wrestling match. Mm-hmm.
It was a wrestling match.
Yeah,
and
it was great.
When I watch it, I don't see stunt people in there. Like, those guys appear to be doing the stuff.
It looked like it. I don't know if they did.
Piper definitely choreographed a lot of that scene, although he wasn't listed as the stunt coordinator for the film. But I know I've seen interviews with him since then, and he and Keith David worked together really closely on that film. I mean, it was iconic.
When you have an athlete of his caliber, you take what he knows and you use it. I mean, Carpenter would have been dumb not to. So that may only make sense.
Oh, man. And the suplex in that alley fight to this day, I'm like,
on the asphalt.
Awesome.
I know, asphalt.
I think the theater I saw, we were cheering because that's what we're waiting for that. Because that's what, you know, we're like, Roddy Piper, he's fighting. He's got to do that. Come on.
And Carpenter tried to talk him out of doing the stunts in that scene, and he said, "The hell with that shit. If you're not gonna not have me do that, what are you paying me for? Because I can't act." So he just wanted to do all the stunts in the movie.
And you know, it's surprising he didn't do more, George, because this is the only film I've ever seen with Roddy Piper in it, and he's fine. He's very much like a young Dwayne Johnson here. Remember, Dwayne Johnson wasn't a great actor when he first started doing films.
Sure.
No.
But he developed chops. Roddy Piper, given the right roles in the 80s, I think he could have become the 90s megastar like The Rock is today, only if he had gotten the chance. Really? But he didn't. He never did, really.
You know, when I first rented this film, I only rented it because of Roddy Piper. Oh, that was the only reason why I wanted
to see
the film. Just
because he was a wrestler and you wanted to see
him. And it turned out to be even crazier. But Roddy Piper, and you know, you make the connection to Dwayne Johnson. Dwayne Johnson has said in a couple of different interviews that if it were not for people like Roddy Piper going into films before him, he would have never been afforded the opportunities that made him the super megastar that he is now. So I think it was not that he didn't want to do films. People just didn't believe wrestlers could act, because you got to remember,
this
is still
in
the
really, you think about it.
Well, right. We know that now, but this is in the era of kayfabe where people were still not sure if wrestling was pre-planned, and people weren't sure if the guys really hated each other or not, because they were such good actors on the fly in the ring, on the microphone, that they could make anyone believe it.
Oh, yeah. Here's your motivation. Get out there, do something. And they're acting under duress. They're being athletes. They're exhausted and maintaining a character. And so clearly Piper had those.
He's from that old school of wrestlers who they were never given a script to read. They were just said, you know, make this point and make this point. You figure out the other 3.5 minutes. And that's it. And so it's all ad lib and improv, like you're saying. It was just, it's crazy.
Yeah, it'd be a pivotal one and a great one to pick for the last one we choose in this section. And before we get out of They Live, you said before we could talk another 45 minutes about easily. Any one of these films easily. Let's hit on our favorite scenes. Mo, what do you got? What are your favorite scene from They Live that you remember?
I just loved when he first gets the sunglasses that lets him see reality.
Right.
Because this movie obviously had a lot of social commentary in it, right?
Yes.
It was very two-class society and all that stuff.
Right, of course.
And then you kind of see, like, when he finally gets it, like, the guy's pulling money out of his wallet, and it says on there, this is your God.
Yeah, on the money,
and the billboards all say, consume, buy,
reproduce, don't think, all those things.
Yeah, basically, they're just manipulating people, which, honestly, I think if this movie was remade today, it would totally still fit. I think they could do a version of this today that would still, I think, resonate really well with people.
And I would watch it, but I would cry if they did it.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. The irony of it is they never explain what's going on. It implies that you'll know later after the film, after the conclusion, but you don't know where they came from. Who's the good? Are we the bad guys? You don't know. You're really unsure. They just let you, you roll with it, just like Roddy Piper does. You don't know.
You know, one of the funny things about this movie is that, you know, the main character has no name. What was Roddy Piper's
name? Well, he does.
But nobody, but they never call him that, though, right?
They don't call him that in the film, but he's, and it's weird because he's credited in the film as Nada, but then there are other scripts that have been released where his name is John Nada.
Yeah.
So,
well, Nada meaning nothing, right? Meaning nothing in Spanish.
Because he's nothing. He's nobody. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But cool. So, John, what was yours?
I think my favorite scene is kind of spread out a little bit, but it's the entire interaction he has with Meg Foster's character. Like, at first, he kind of abducts her, and then they have this dialogue in her apartment where he wants her to try the glasses, and she has this great line where she says, I'll look, but no matter what I see, I'm going to say I see what you said I should see.
Right. So how do you know I'm telling the truth?
She defends herself, shoves him out the window. He goes rolling down the hill. And when they meet back up again, the line that I love is she sees him and goes, I thought I killed you. And his response is, so did I. Like, yeah, you beat my ass and threw me out the window like 5 stories and down a hill. It's that dialogue and that back and forth with her that it's kind of stretched out through the relationship, but it's kind of a cheat. It's multiple scenes, but together I like that interaction.
Yeah, for sure.
What about you, George? Favorite scene?
Oh, I think it's got to be the ending scene, honestly. And I think
what part of the ending?
So there's an ending when Roddy Piper finally makes it up to the roof of the television studio building. Finally blows
stop the signal.
Device that stops the signal. And so all the aliens are being revealed to us. You know, they start showing them in different scenes where people, like, there's an alien sitting in a bar and people are looking at him like, you know, what the hell?
Where'd you come from?
Newscasters and stuff.
Real quickly, that's the first time you see the aliens in color.
It is.
Oh, yes, it's true. Yes,
they're
all
black and white because you see them through glasses until then. And finally, you see them in color. That was kind of shocking.
Yeah, because even when they get their color contacts later on, you never see anything through their eyes.
Good point.
Yeah. So there's the ending scene where it goes to a hotel room and there's a beautiful blonde woman.
Oh, right.
And she's having sex with somebody. And so you're just looking at her. She's on top and, you know, she's nude from the waist up and everything. And she looks back over at the TV and it's the newscasters being revealed.
And then
she looks down at the guy and he's one of the aliens and she freaks out and stops and he goes, hey, babe, what's the matter? End scene. That's the end of the movie.
And
I love
credits.
That.
That's it. Yeah, that was what I was implying, that it's at that point that they're going to start finding out what the hell's going on, but we don't get to see any of that. So it's left wide open.
Yeah, you never know what happens. I'm actually surprised they did not make a sequel, actually.
Well, it seemed like it was wasn't kind of open terribly for successful in the theaters. It was one of those cult classics that caught on in VHS rentals. And, you know, those films didn't often get remakes or sequels, even though they became successful in the VHS market. They just
That's a modern thing.
Yeah.
Oh, man. What's the matter, babe? What's the matter? The world just blew up, so what's the matter?
You got purple and pink spots all over you. And weird glass bug eyes. What the hell?
Masters!
What do these things want, and why are they here?
You still don't get it, do you, boy?
They have recruited the rich and the powerful.
They're running the whole show.
Wake up! They're all about you, all around you. Blinded us to the truth.
Take a look. They are safe as long as they are not discovered.
I don't know what they are or where they came from, but we gotta stop them.
Stay away from me.
Put these on.
They have us. Look at them. They're everywhere.
If there was anything in this show you'd like to learn more about, the show notes which accompany each episode are full of links to click and explore. Catch up on past episodes and get pinged every time a new one's released by subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts. And you know, iTunes reviews help more than you know, so if you haven't yet, please rate and review us in the iTunes app. And if you have a friend who isn't yet listening, why not? Tell them about us, they'll thank you later. You're our fourth listener, and we'd love to read your emails right here on the show, so hit us up at podcast@genxgrownup.com. And finally, Gen X Grown Up is more than just this podcast. Our YouTube channel has hundreds of videos ready for you to enjoy, plus you can find our entire body of work on genxgrownup.com. This has been a blast looking back on these Carpenter films. And there are so many we missed. I know they're probably favorites of many of our listeners. You'll let us know when you hit us up on our email. Before we get out of this show, I absolutely always like to take just a second here to give our gratitude to the folks that support us financially, allow us to keep doing what we do here on the podcast, over on YouTube, and on the website. This is folks that give a few bucks every single month through Patreon. And I want to thank each of you. Adam, Agil, Thomas, Ben, Slowmo, Shelby, Chewbacca, Butter Spider, Levi, Travis, T2, Matt, Dana, Jason, Steen, Mike C, Greg L, Dan, Davis, Mark, Lee, Greg, Z, David, Tony, Arlen Blaster, Stasha, Chad, Marcus, Chet, Jonathan, H, Sean, and Stew Monkey, who just arbitrarily upped his contribution from $5 to $7.50 every month just because he wanted to say, hey, thank you so much to each and every one of you. You're amazing in our eyes. If you'd like to join this roster, George, would you let the fourth listeners know how they can get that done?
Absolutely, sir. We've got two ways for you to get there. All you got to do is go to patreon.com/GenXGrownUp or genxgrownup.com/Patreon, because we wanted to make it easy on you in case you had a short-term memory.
Like us.
When you get over there, all you do is you take that free account, create that thing, then you go over to the non-free section, decide how much you would like to contribute to us per month. $1, we love you, you love us. $2, we love each other double as much. $3 gets you into all the behind-the-scenes stuff. $5 gets you into that Gen X Grownup swag. And we have even instituted a new method of support. We've recently come to a 10,000 subscriber membership level in YouTube, and that afforded us the ability to add a little button called Join, and you become a YouTube member with that button. It's $2.99 per month right now, and you get all these cool YouTube options. You get these custom like little emoji graphic things that you can have
the
on your name
by
and
your
put
name
in the chat.
That shows you're a member. So much cool
shows
stuff.
Shows you how long everything. It's really fun. It's a lot of awesome. That's all I
and
can say.
And people have
about
really
it.
Been enjoying it. So awesome. Well said, George. Absolutely. We thank you again for your support. Every single one of you. We know it's tough times too, and it means even doubly as much. That is going to wrap it up for this Backtrack edition of the show. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another one, but next week with a regular entry in our show. Until then, I am John. George, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, sir.
Mo, you know I appreciate you, buddy.
Oh, man, always fun.
Fourth listener, it's you we appreciate most of all, though, and we will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
See you guys.
Take care, everybody.
Gen X Grown Up is a member of the Evergreen Podcast family. Learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com. No more washy shows till sunrise. Unacceptable for grown-ups. Your dinner cannot just be french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up. You don't want to miss this one, January 21st. Hope you'll hear it. Hope you'll hear it. The fuck was that? What does that mean? Hope you'll hear it. I like English
What's
talking.
What's the matter, babe?
What's the matter, babe? I'll do it one more time. Shit, 3, 2. Don't miss it. Much better. Fucking. I hope you hear the word and talking. All right.
You know, a lot can happen in 7 minutes, and luckily, that's how long it takes me to tell a story. My name is Aaron Calafato, and I'm the creator of 7-Minute Stories. I'm proud to partner with Evergreen Podcasts, and I'd like to invite you to join me on this journey. I'm going to take you on some crazy roller coaster rides using my unique extemporaneous storytelling style, and together, we're going to try to make sense of the world, all through the art of storytelling, and all in approximately 7 minutes.